This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pancava. What should the government do about global warming? That's the question, the political question, that two big names in American politics took up in a recent debate. Newt Gingrich, the Republican former Speaker of the House, and John Kerry, the 2004 Democratic presidential candidate, both accept that global warming is a problem caused by human activity. But they disagree about how the government should respond to that problem. Gingrich, who is currently a senior fellow at the conservative American Enterprise Institute, is considering entering the race for president. Kerry has said he plans to remain in the U.S. Senate and will not seek the presidency next year. Their debate was organized by New York University's nonpartisan John Brademas Center for the Study of Congress. It's named for the former NYU president who represented Indiana in Congress as a Democrat for 22 years. Brademas, by the way, was at the event. Newt Gingrich, who is coming out with a book on the environment this fall called Contract with the Earth, began by saying that he actually agrees with 60% of what Senator Kerry says in Kerry's new book, This Moment on Earth, Today's New Environmentalists and Their Vision for the Future. Here then, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich opening the debate held April 10th in Washington.
What I want to focus on today is I want to suggest that we need a new science and technology-based, entrepreneurial, market-oriented, and locally led environmentalism. I'm going to expand on this at a meeting next Wednesday called EcoVision and try to outline it in much greater detail than we have time for today. But I want to start with this idea that one of the major places we're going to disagree will be over what's the right strategy for getting to a better environment and what are the right mechanisms for moving the human race to that environment. Now, I believe deeply in biodiversity. In fact, I was very proud that Edward O. Wilson at one point said that I was the key person in saving the Endangered Species Act in the late 1990s. I also have a vested personal interest. I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but my name, Newt, actually comes from the Danish Canute, and there's been a major crisis in Germany over a polar bear named Canute. And I want to share this with you as a starting point. Canute, the polar bear, was born in December, and his mother ignored him. And he was going to starve to death. And in nature, this happens fairly often. I mean, Mother Nature can be very tough. The zoo decided to intervene. It became very controversial. One of the animal rights activists in Germany said, quote, "Feeding by hand is not species appropriate, but a gross violation of animal protection laws. The zoo must kill the bear." Now, there was a huge public outcry, as you can imagine. The bear won. The activist lost. But I want to start with that because I want to propose to you that very often you can get involved in ideological fights where people can get enormously angry when, in fact, common sense could lead to solutions that work, but they may not fit the ideology. So let me start with the UN report. The United Nations actually reported recently on three things. It reported that there is a general consensus that over the last 100 years, that the Earth has gotten warmer, and that is probably true for about 400 years. But as the National Academy of Sciences reported several years ago, the fact is we don't have enough data for more than about 400 years of knowledge, and we're not actually sure what happened earlier in terms of the planet. And a good example of that would be the fact that at 11,000 years ago, the Gulf Stream stopped, and for 600 years, Europe had a little ice age, which then the Gulf Stream started back up, and Europe lost a little ice age. There is today no consensus about why the Gulf Stream stopped or why it started again. But there is a consensus that for the last 100 years, the planet's gotten somewhat warmer. The second consensus is that humans have contributed to that. I don't think there's any consensus that we are the only contribution, but there is a clear agreement that human activity has helped increase the level of warmness. Third, I believe it is a fact that the computer simulations, which are only computer simulations, show that over the next century, there is a probable increase in the sea level between 7 and 23 inches. That's very important, between 7 and 23 inches over the next century. Very different than the sense that we will be in a catastrophe within a decade. So it is a problem. We should address it. and we should address it very actively. How would we address it? Well, I would propose that we need a generation of solutions, but that we also need to understand that economic growth really matters. If you design an environmental strategy which is anti-economic growth, first of all, you doom sub-Saharan Africa to a disaster of enormous misery, something which is skipped over by many of the people who talk about this subject. The Gallup poll now does a worldwide survey. They do 125 countries. They are committed to doing it every year for the next 100 years. There are countries in sub-Saharan Africa where clean water and mosquito netting are not the highest priority. The highest priority is physical safety from being raped or killed. And so I have to start with the idea we have an absolute requirement as a human race to be committed to economic growth. We also have a requirement, if we're going to be realistic about the environment, to be committed to economic growth in China and India, which means any serious strategy has to be thinking through what would green development look like in Africa and what would a green economy look like in China and India. And for that to happen, I would argue that we have to have a very strong commitment to finding new incentives, to use new science and new technology, and to maximize the rate of innovation. Because you actually would like, the Chinese are going to have cars. The question is, could we accelerate the development of hydrogen cars so the cars they have don't add to carbon loading? The Indians are going to have air conditioning. The question is, can we accelerate the transition to an environmentally sensitive air conditioning at an affordable price so that they will buy it? We're not going to coerce these two countries into a regulatory regime. And they are quite clear about this. And if you look at the Gallup poll data, if you ask them to choose between the environment and economic growth, both countries are going to pick economic growth. So the challenge to us to lead the world, and I agree entirely with whatever criticism the senator wants to make in general about the absence of American leadership. I'm not going to stand up here and defend our failure to lead. I am going to say our leadership should start with science, technology, entrepreneurship, and that we should focus on developing new approaches. One of the things I want to suggest is that for real breakthroughs, we also want to parallel the processes we've been using at the National Science Foundation, the Department of Energy, the National Institutes of Health. We want to parallel them by offering substantial prizes. Prizes historically have had a big impact. In 1919, Ortega offered $25,000 to fly to Paris from New York, and in 1927, Charles Lindbergh collected that prize, becoming the first person to fly across. The XPRIZE offered $10 million to be the first private sector development to go into near space, and over $200 million was spent by people trying to win the prize. The original breakthrough in this was the Royal Society, the British government offering £20,000 for developing a new way of navigating, and it led to a fundamental breakthrough in the Royal Navy's ability to go around the world and know where they were. One final example, there's a firm in Toronto which offered a $575,000 prize, put all of its mining data online, and ended up with two Australians who'd never been to Canada telling them where to mine, and they made, I think, over $150 million for $575,000. I cite that because we ought to today have a prize for the first hydrogen car. We should today be having prizes for cars that get 500 and 1,000 miles to the gallon. We should be moving towards ways to develop a whole series of new green technologies. There was a report just yesterday of a breakthrough in New Zealand on solar power, which may reduce the cost of solar power by 90%. I checked last night with friends of mine at Georgia Tech who are working on this area, and they agree that within the next decade, it is very likely that solar power can be competitive with hydropower or coal power as a way of generating electricity. So I think thinking boldly about how to incentivize entrepreneurship and thinking boldly about how to create this can work. My final point, and then I look forward to hearing from the senator, and then I'm sure we're going to have an interesting dialogue about this. My final point would be this. I taught in the Second Earth Day. I used the limits to growth. I used Paul Ehrlich's The Population Time Bomb, which was, by the way, totally wrong. I mean, indefensibly wrong. You go back and look at it, it's astonishingly wrong. But at the time, we were all into catastrophes. I remember in the mid-1970s when Time and Newsweek warned we were entering an ice age. Both of them ran long articles explaining that all science believed that we were entering an ice age. We've been through catastrophism. I think what we have to have is optimism. And I'll just close with these two thoughts. One, regulation and litigation are the least effective method of getting to solutions. Rewarding entrepreneurship, investing in science and technology, reshaping the market with incentives are the fastest ways to get to change. And lastly, and this is where I disagree with the second half of the UN report, which is essentially about politics and sociology, not about science. The human race has enormous capacity to adapt if we apply ourselves in a positive way to do it. One third of Holland is below sea level, and the Dutch don't seem panicked. In fact, because they face their job responsibly, the Dutch have dealt with far greater problems than we failed to deal with in New Orleans. And I think there's a really grim parallel to look at those two examples. The right steps taken in the right way, using the right engineering and the right science, can lead to a much healthier planet with people who have plenty of food, who live better than they do today, in an environment that has more biodiversity. But it does take a positive, aggressive effort to think through how to apply these new strategies. And I look forward to the dialogue both with the Senator and with the rest of you.
Thank you.
Newt Gingrich, who served as the Republican Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives from 1994 to 1998, making his opening statement in a recent debate over how government should respond to the threat of global warming. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. Facing off against Gingrich was 2004 Democratic presidential candidate and Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. Kerry, who, unlike Gingrich, has ruled out running for president this time around, is out with a new book called This Moment on Earth, Today's New Environmentalists and Their Vision for the Future. Here's Senator Kerry's opening statement.
So welcome to our environmental version of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I want you to know we flipped a coin and I picked Lincoln. Here's the essence of what I just heard from Newt. You correct me if I'm wrong. He says that he accepts that it's happening, something's happening. He takes the consensus of the UN report, but then essentially says what we need to do to respond to that is encourage the marketplace to go out and respond. And unleash science and unleash technology, all of which I agree with. I have no argument about prizes. In fact, in 2004, I advocated that we create some prizes and we ought to excite the marketplace to do things. So what he does is he has come here today and sort of plunked in front of you the notion that something's happening. Yeah, the UN report is sort of real. But on the other hand, not such a crisis that we have to respond quickly or immediately. We can just let the marketplace go by exciting the marketplace, and somehow that will work. And he talks about the economic benefits of creating these new incentives in order to maximize the transformation. Now, I believe in the marketplace. The book that he just referred to you talks about the power of the marketplace to get us through this, ultimately. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But there is a place to begin here, and I want to begin at the beginning. In fact, I'm a little confused about sort of where Newt comes from on this, because only 2 years ago at the University of Vermont, he went up there and said to people, there's no evidence at all for global climate change. None. This is a quote. He said, it is cultural anthropology. And if you go to his website today, leave this room and go to the website, his website will say that he sort of takes on scientists who are signing on to ads that we have to do something urgently because he says there's no scientific proof. Now, I don't think you can have it every which way. You either believe the science or you don't believe the science. You can't be halfway pregnant on this. You can't believe half the science. Science is science. Newt knows that. So let's begin with the science for a minute, if we can. And I just want to do this for a moment because it's critical to weigh this as you weigh a judgment about what is enough in order to be able to respond adequately to this crisis. Greenhouse effect, greenhouse gases, what does that mean? Well, greenhouse wasn't something that was just sort of conjured up as a notion to fit the gas problem, carbon dioxide, methane, halocarbons, the other greenhouse gases. Greenhouse is a concept that has been with us because it defines how life itself is here on Earth. Without a greenhouse effect, ladies and gentlemen, the Earth would be 60 degrees cooler. We would not exist. It is the greenhouse effect that keeps a balance between the energy of the sun that comes in and what goes out. And it's that balance that maintains an equilibrium of about 57 degrees average temperature on Earth. That's how we live. So once you have accepted the fundamental science of how we live and how we exist on Earth, of why there is a greenhouse effect, then you have to take the science the next step and say, okay, what happens when you add something to that greenhouse? The greenhouse effect, the sunlight comes in. The atmosphere is relatively transparent to sunlight because of the wavelength of the energy of the sunlight. So it comes in, hits the Earth, bounces up off some reflectance like ice, snow, other kinds of things like aerosols in the air, and it bounces back. But some of it's absorbed, and that creates energy in and of itself. That energy then goes back up, but in a longer wave, so it's opaque. It can't get through the atmosphere, ladies and gentlemen. This is all science. And because the heat can't get through the atmosphere, as you add more gases, carbon dioxide, etc., you make it more opaque, harder for the heat to escape. What happens? The same thing that happens in any greenhouse anywhere in the world, it heats up. Now, we can trace scientifically. By measuring the ice cores, we know that the temperature of the Earth has gone up, and we know the rate of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone up. Before the Industrial Revolution, we had about 600 billion tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We measured about 280 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We can measure that, and NUTT is accurate. It goes back that 400 years where it's absolutely accurate. It's a little more iffy about where it may have been after that. I will acknowledge that. But not unmeasurable and not discernible in terms of science and what you can extrapolate from it. You can see 1,000 years of the chart of carbon dioxide measurements and of temperature measurements through trees and ice core. Now, we know there were 600 billion. We know that it's 280 parts per million. Why is that important? Because we also know that at the end of the Industrial Revolution, now, after 200 years, we've gone up to about 380 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And this is relevant because the best scientists America has to offer, people like Jim Hansen at NASA, Bob Correll, Ed Miles, a whole bunch of people who are distinguished for a lifetime of research, in peer-reviewed studies, studies that have been anonymously reviewed by their fellow scientists for methodology and for outcome, have concluded that we could only tolerate, in fact, up until a year ago, they concluded we could only tolerate up to 550 parts per million in the atmosphere before you get to a tipping point of catastrophe. Now they've revised that estimate, ladies and gentlemen. They revised it because the science is coming back so rapidly. As one scientist said to me the other day, he's more alarmed than he was in sounding alarm bells. Why? Because the rate of the return of the evidence and the scope of the return of the evidence is so much more than even they predicted. So they are beginning to say to us, we can't tolerate a 3 degree centigrade increase up to 550 parts per million. The most that we can tolerate is 450 parts per million up to 2 degrees centigrade. Why is this important? Carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases have a half-life. They live beyond their immersion into the atmosphere. Some may be up to 1,000 years. But it is an absolute certainty that the carbon dioxide that has been put into the atmosphere today, this extra 100 or so parts per million, will continue to do damage for the next 70 to 100 years and beyond. So even if we could stop all emissions tomorrow, and we can't, and we know that, damage will continue to be done just as it has been done since the Industrial Revolution. We have increased the Earth's temperature by 0.8 degrees centigrade until this moment. That means you will have at least up to about 1.4, 1.5 degrees centigrade increase no matter what we do, which leaves you a cushion of about 0.6 degrees between that and the tipping point. That's why this is urgent. That's why you can't just sit there and say, oh, let the market respond. And that's like saying, Barry Bonds, go investigate steroids. Or like saying, Enron, you take over the pensions for America. Not going to happen. Now, Newt knows as well as I do, and I give him credit for this. In the 1990s, Newt joined in a legitimate effort here in Congress to respond to this kind of crisis. That was in the Clean Air Act, ladies and gentlemen. When I was a lieutenant governor, I led one of the first governor task forces in the country to look at this. We designed cap and trade during the course of that. And we found that we had to reduce the sulfur dioxide levels in the atmosphere because acid rain was killing our lakes and streams and our fish and rivers. What did we do? With George Herbert Walker Bush, with Bill Riley, with a Republican administration, notwithstanding unbelievable screams from the utilities and from industry, who said, don't do this to us. It's going to cost $8 billion. It's going to take 10 years. You'll kill us in the marketplace. We joined together and we did it. The environment movement said, no, it's not going to cost $8 billion. It's only going to cost about $4 billion, and we'll do it in about 5 years. Guess what? It costs half that, and we did it in half the time. Why? Because we put the mandate out there, we set the standard of behavior, and the industry followed that standard of behavior. And ultimately, when you give technology that kind of goal, we didn't pick a winner or a loser. We set a structure. And within that framework, industry responded. And once technology starts to move down a road, nobody has the ability to predict what kind of technology gain builds on what kind of technology gain. Now there, Newt and I will agree. What I want to see is us do what everyone of common sense is now saying we ought to do. It's not just the UN report, ladies and gentlemen. There are 11 National Academy of Science is around the world, who joined together in 2006 to say prompt action must be taken now. Our own National Academy of Sciences joined in that. Our own EPA, even under this administration in 2002, acknowledged that human activity is creating this problem and we have to respond to reduce it and reduce it now. But nothing's happened, and they acknowledged it. Now, most significantly, the very people that Newt most relies on to respond are screaming for us to do something. Jeff Immelt, CEO of General Electric, has put huge investment from General Electric into this kind of technology. They've upped the revenues of General Electric selling eco-imagination goods. They've turned it around and have now some $17 billion of orders online. And they're desperately pleading for us to set a national price on carbon. In fact, their strategy ultimately relies on that. Walmart is already beginning to make these kinds of moves. And CEO Scott is focused on how this is better for business, better for the consumers, and ultimately puts them in a less risky position by doing it. PG&E, DuPont, Dow Chemical, 3M, IBM have all taken major steps to reduce emissions, but they all say we need an economy-wide cap in order to create the rules of the road, in order to make it clear to everybody what the fairness standards would be, in order to draw everybody to the same standard of effort and behavior. And that's the only way they say the market is going to respond, ladies and gentlemen. Now, why should we do this? What compels us to think about doing this? And I'll just try to wrap this up very quickly. The evidence is overwhelming. The fact is that you have an increase in forest fires, you have an increase in droughts, you have an increase in the movement of species, in the range of those species, some 130 species. This is a crisis. Glaciers are melting. In 1850, when we measured the glaciers of Montana, there were about 150, I think, or so. Today, there are 27, and they're all melting. and so are the rest of the glaciers in the rest of the world. The fact is the Arctic ice is melting, down some 20% in its mass, and the Greenland ice sheet is beginning to melt, and you can look at the levels of increased melting in the last years. You just have to apply common sense to it. Greenland ice sheet is on rock. As the melting takes place underneath it, some scientists tell me there's a fear that as that gets wet, you have a slippery, a sliding capacity, and you might have whole chunks begin to slide. They can't say it is going to happen. I can't tell you it is going to happen. I can tell you this, when I hear scientists worrying about it, I say, gee, maybe we ought to apply the precautionary principle of human beings. First, do no harm. First, do no harm. So when you add, and there are many, many more other indicators than I've just gone through, this is all science. All science. So I listen. When Sir Nicholas Stern, a respected international economist, says, quote, our actions now and over the coming decades could create risks of major disruption to economic and social activity on a scale similar to those associated with the Great Wars and economic depression of the first half of the 20th century. Should we listen to that or should we not? Delay dramatically increases the risks, ladies and gentlemen. The current plans for reduction are to have about a 3.2% reduction per year if we start now. But if we don't start now, and there is no standard set, and you wait 10 to 20 years before you really get a global regime, then you're going to need an 8% or higher reduction in order to do what you need to do. Moreover, all the engineered infrastructure that we depend on today, our dikes in New Orleans, our sewer systems, our water overflows, all of the bridges and rivers, all of the dams that we have, they're all geared to 100-year flood level. But if indeed the increased precipitation levels go on, and if indeed we see more intensive storms, and if indeed the ocean rises the meter that John Holdren, professor of sciences at Harvard, says it will, then you're going to have that infrastructure overwhelmed. And every dollar we invest today in a new coal-fired power plant or another plant is one more dollar that's going to become more expensive to change down the road when you have to retrofit or go back, and those capital costs have been wasted.
Senator, that's a...
I will wind up.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a moral obligation. It's one in which we can make money. That's what those business leaders realize. We need to show the leadership. It's the only way to get China and India to participate, and that's why you have to take this with a global pricing of carbon, certainly economy-wide in the United States to start with, and we need to offer the leadership.
Massachusetts Senator and 2004 Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry laying out his position in a recent debate with former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich. The debate was not over whether there was global warming, but rather over what government should do to reduce it. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Following their opening statements, Kerry and Gingrich were given an opportunity to respond to one another's arguments. We'll begin with former Speaker Gingrich's response to Senator Kerry.
There's too much to try to go through and one by one, so let me go to the core question. I think it comes down to three big questions. If you assume for a minute that you want to take the most serious view of this. The first question ought to be the one that Dennis Smith has worked on so much, and that's metrics. What does a real solution look like? It is radically bigger and more complex than the current proposals. I mean, if you take the worst possible case, and you say, we have to shift the behavior of the human race by a large enough amount, fast enough, then we need a lot more bold thinking. And I don't think it can be done by a regulatory litigation regime, because I don't think this country will pass it, and I am certain China and India won't pass it. And if these three countries don't pass it, it isn't going to happen. So you look at the level of coercion you would need to get this kind of change out of a regulatory litigation regime, and I do not think it's enforceable. I'm talking about the whole, I'm not just talking about cap and trade. I'm talking about, given the scale of the crisis that is described by those who are the most concerned, they then come back to an increase in government power. If only we had a bigger bureaucracy doing what we say the current bureaucracies don't do. And my first question is, what evidence have you gotten? And cap and trade, by the way, for sulfuric acid and acid rain, which I voted for and helped pass as the Republican whip, was a very definable number of plants. A carbon cap and trade, if it's universal, is enormously complicated and transfers an amazing amount of power to a Washington bureaucracy and will create inevitably winners and losers and will become politicized overnight. So I start with, I want a really big solution. I believe a really big solution has to mean very rapid change. And I believe, and this is a core argument, I'm not talking about a laissez-faire market. I'm in the Alexander Hamilton, Theodore Roosevelt model. I'm for an incentivized market where, for example, we have very substantial tax credits for the auto industry to convert over to dramatically better cars. We have a very substantial tax credit to trade in the oldest and most polluting of cars. We have a very significant tax credit to go to a clean coal technology. Because if you don't help provide the capital, the morning you provide the incentives, there will be 50,000 entrepreneurs figuring out how to get the money. The morning you try to do it by regulation, there will be 50,000 entrepreneurs hiring a lawyer to fight you. It's a fundamentally different model. The Superfund model was the litigation regulation model. It has been a mess. States clean up Superfund sites much faster and much cheaper than the federal government because they have a common sense, totally different approach. And I would just say, take a look at that. What you don't want to do is try to move towards carbon the way we move towards Superfund, because it has been objectively a failure. Second, we have to have strategies that invent entire new generations of products, which I would argue is a very fast way to change. America changes very rapidly in the marketplace, much faster than it does in bureaucracy. Those of you who have cell phones with cameras are living proof. Those of you who use automatic teller machines are living proof. Those of you who have BlackBerries are living proof. We can move very rapidly if we're moving there as consumers, because science and technology and entrepreneurs have combined to offer us better choices. And I think, and the reason I think you have to focus on these kind of breakthroughs is because you have to make it desirable for India and China to adopt a green economy. And that means it has to be economically beneficial as well as environmentally beneficial. And that requires a new generation of activities. Lastly, there is, I think, a very important requirement that we look carefully at how we're designing this. There was a story yesterday in the Washington Post on the way in which the Europeans have tried to implement cap and trade, and the degree to which what they're actually starting to do is export pollution. So what happens is they set up a requirement. The specific example they used was making concrete. So the relatively good environmental concrete maker goes out of business and is replaced by a Moroccan concrete maker, which makes zero investment in the environment. We've done some of this with China and India already. So we say it's too expensive to do this in the U.S. These large corporations don't say, oh, please let me lose money so I can stay in the U.S. They promptly start buying products from Taiwan, Thailand, Pakistan, India, China, which actually have worse environmental records. I think our challenge has to be to think through how you genuinely solve the problem here. And I think the answers are very clear cut. As I said earlier, if we had a 20-year tax credit for wind power, South Dakota alone can provide 10% of the energy, electricity of the United States through wind power by itself. If we had a serious effort for ethanol, and you mentioned this in your book, if we had a serious effort for E85 and made it available at stations, and I agree with Senator Kerry's proposal that we should incentivize the gas stations to retrofit in order to have E85, it dramatically improves gasoline usage, and it dramatically improves carbon loading. There are new technologies that are going to take carbon out of coal, and they're going to take carbon out of the existing atmosphere. I mean, there are things that are happening where it's very likely that we're going to be able to sequester carbon in huge quantities in a way which will make a difference. And it's conceivable within 20 years you will actually see a decline in carbon in the atmosphere if we make the right kind of investment. So we're not arguing over whether it should be urgent. We're arguing over whether bureaucracy and litigation is a better way to be urgent, or whether science and technology translated by entrepreneurs into products is a better way to be urgent. And I would argue, most of American history argues, that the market can move faster than a bureaucracy to provide solutions if you incentivize the market. I agree. You have to incentivize it. I'm not for a laissez-faire approach. But I think if you consciously set out to create a green economy, you might be startled how rapidly it changed.
Nietzsche said that we are arguing over bureaucracy and litigation. No, we're not. We're not arguing over bureaucracy and litigation. We're arguing over the level of the urgency and whether or not, in fact, a government cap, a price on carbon, is, in fact, bureaucracy, and whether or not it even invites and is possible to have litigation. I'll tell you why it isn't. We did it. We did it on sulfur dioxide. The same arguments were made that I hear today from Newt, notwithstanding that he voted for that. But you heard the same arguments, folks. The industry came in and said, don't do this, it could be too expensive. We'll just let the market work on its own. Why didn't we just let the market work on its own? Well, I'll tell you why. Because it was clear to us that you needed to create both the leverage as well as the market, if you will. So they would go out and invest in the technology because they don't invest in that kind of expensive technology without it. I'll give you an example. TXU down in Texas was about to build 11 new coal-fired pulverized plants in Texas. And it took the environmental community to come in the context of a sale to argue with them, you can't do that. And so they've now agreed to lessen the number they're going to build and to build the new ones with the so-called integrated gasification combined cycle technology and then ultimately sequester carbon. AEP, I think one of our largest power companies in America, Columbus, Ohio, is building two new plants, one in West Virginia, one in Ohio, both with this new technology. But they're pleading for us to set the standard so everybody's on an even playing field and everybody knows where they're going. And that's the only way you invite people to make those investments. Now, you know, what's the example on this? It wasn't volunteerism or some incentive that got people to have meat inspections in America, so you eat clean meat. It wasn't volunteerism and just an incentive that got the auto industry to get safety in its autos and have seat belts and airbags. It took Ralph Nader and a fight and a whole bunch of effort of citizens and consumers to get a government standard in place. Same thing with the Montreal Protocol and CFCs. We had to sign an agreement, set a standard. Then the companies went, in fact, and this is true, I think it's DuPont, had the technology to cure the CFCs, but until the standard was there, it wasn't economically viable for them to bring it to market. So it took the government setting the standard to get DuPont to make the decision and come on board. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when we put the Clean Air Act in place, the allowances were priced at about $1,500. Everybody said, oh my God, this is going to be expensive. Within moments of it being put in place, the market took those allowances down to about $700, then they went down to $100, then they went down to $70, then they bounced back up to $90. Do you know how much the utilities made the year after we imposed that state standard without litigation and without bureaucracy? 5% increase in revenues the next year. They've made a 67% increase since 1990. They're doing great. And the American economy grew by $5.45 billion in its trillion dollars in its total GDP. We've had an economy that's grown 10 times since we put that in place. So you can't listen to this sort of, this is going to be bureaucracy. There's no bureaucracy. You set the standard. The market will set the price. The market will decide what the cost of carbon is. And right now what's happening is we're all living in a world where we're not paying for the cost of what we're doing because we don't pay for the cost of the loss of those fish. We don't pay for the cost of the cancer that may come with the pollution that comes into your lungs. We don't pay for the cost of what happens in the diminution of quality of our environment, the loss of these species. None of that is priced into the goods today. Now, final comment I make on that quickly is China, I want to speak to that for a minute. I was at those negotiations in Kyoto. I was at the negotiations of the conferences in The Hague and in Buenos Aires. I've talked to the Chinese delegations. The reason they were reluctant to participate at first is they saw it as a Western conspiracy to prevent them from growing. But they now are increasingly aware they've got a major problem. They've got glaciers that are also melting that feed the Yangtze River. And, they're major, they've got 300 or 400 million people who depend on that water. They're concerned. They are going green now with green building. In fact, doing more green building in many ways than we are. They're building some several hundred million housing units, and they're trying to build them all green. A fellow that we write about in our book named Bill McDonough has been going over to China to help China learn how to do green development. We need to do more of it here. So I believe that if you show the leadership in the United States and set this standard, we will have the clean hands and the leverage that we need to be able to go to India and China and bring the world together. They're waiting for our leadership, and that's what's critical. And final comment, what does Jeff Immelt know that people who resist this don't know? What is the CEO of Pittsburgh Gas and Electric? What does the CEO of Florida Power and Electric? They want this cap. They understand that this is the way to reduce carbon. Ladies and gentlemen, there's only one way to deal with global climate change. 80 to 85% of the problem is carbon. We have to become a carbon neutral society. And that will not happen just by incentive.
Massachusetts Senator John Kerry in a recent debate with former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich. You're hearing them on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. Later on in the debate, Senator Kerry mentioned Oklahoma Republican Senator James Inhofe, who famously called global warming, quote, the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. Senator Kerry.
What would you say to Senator Inhofe and to others in the Senate who are resisting even the science? What's your message to them here today?
My message, I think, is that the evidence is sufficient that we should move towards the most effective possible steps to reduce carbon loading of the atmosphere.
And do it urgently, now.
And do it urgently, yes. But let me, if I can, let me explain partly why this is a very challenging thing to do if you're a conservative. For most of the last 30 years, the environment has been a powerful emotional tool for bigger government and higher taxes. And therefore, if you're a conservative, the minute you start hearing these arguments, you know what's coming next, which is bigger government and higher taxes. So even though it may be the right thing to do, you end up fighting it because you don't want the bigger government and higher taxes. And so you end up in these kind of cycles. And part of the reason I was delighted to accept John Bradamus's invitation, and I'm delighted to be here with Senator Kerry, is I think there has to be a green conservatism. There has to be a willingness to stand up and say, all right, here's the right way to solve these as seen by our value system. And now to have a dialogue about what's the most effective way to solve it, rather than to get into a fight over whether or not to solve it. When I was Speaker, I think it's fair to say that on things, on a whole range of biodiversity issues, I intervened again and again on the side of the environment.
Absolutely.
I really do believe... But I think it's very, I would be delighted to see open-ended hearings. I don't mean in time, but I mean in terms of the topic. That started and said, if we're serious about a dramatic global reduction in carbon loading over the next 20 years, starting immediately, I'm not talking about in 20, if we're serious about it, what are the different models that might work? And are there, in fact, incentive-based, market-oriented models that would work as well or faster? And is there a chance they would produce the technologies that would make it easier for India and China to decide you can have green prosperity? Because if you can develop green prosperity, you change the entire trajectory for the planet, not just for the U.S. I would love to see, and Senator Kerry certainly has far more influence with Majority Leader Reid than I do, but I would love to see hearings that didn't start by saying, let's have a fight over cap and trade. Which I think is, they can probably eventually pass something, but I think is not the way to start. The way to start is to say, what are the optimum choices we can make strategically to minimize carbon loading in the next 20 years? And I believe we can bring a science and technology and entrepreneurship incentive-based model that would at least be worth being considered seriously by the House and Senate.
Well, I think, first of all, I think your statement is a very, very important one. And acknowledge that indeed, when you were Speaker, you did stand up on the biodiversity issues and you joined constructively in this other effort on the sulfur dioxide. I think that in the end, I believe that the time frame by which we have to do this is going to dictate that you still have to look to this market mechanism of pricing carbon. I don't know anybody serious who's looked at this over a long period of time who doesn't somehow feel, if they accept the science, I mean, there's still some folks out there arguing flat earth, you know, policy, but that's always been true all through history. Right now, we have to figure out, I think, as you said, the most effective way. What I keep coming back to, and it's not because I want to land there, it's because the people who are out in the marketplace who have to cope with this are arguing powerfully, the CEOs of these companies, that the only way for them to really be able to do this with their shareholders, their boards of directors, the capital outflow they have to engage in, is to know that there is this pricing mechanism across the economy. And the minute that happens, we step back. What we do is set the standard, and then it's going to be obviously enforced, but just like we enforce clean water standards or clean air standards when they've been enforced. So again, I the urgency of this, when Jim Hansen at NASA, who spent a lifetime leading the Goddard Space Institute, who's been a groundbreaker, in 1988, Jim Hansen came to Congress and said global warming is happening. He was met in 1988 by a waft of criticism. In 1992, I went down to Rio with Al Gore, who led the delegation, with a bipartisan delegation, Senator John Chafee, others. And there we agreed with President George Herbert Walker Bush and Environmental Protection Agency Chief Bill Riley, we had to create a voluntary framework, ladies and gentlemen. We've lived with this voluntary framework now for 15 years. It hasn't worked. Carbon dioxide emissions have gone up 20% since we agreed to have a voluntary reduction. So can I stand here and listen to Newt say to me, incentives alone are going to do this? No, not when Jim Hansen tells me you've got a 10-year window to get this right. And not when I see the rate of damage returns that are coming into us now. When scientists sit there and say to me, the more we get together and the more we talk about this, the more alarmed we become, believe me, the more alarmed I become as a public servant. So I think, Newt, I respect and I know what you're saying. And I frankly appreciate the candor of your acknowledgement of sort of the conservative dilemma there. I understand that. But I think this is one where people have just got to look at the scientific facts and measure those warnings and say, what's my responsibility as a public person to get this right? I don't want to look at my kids and say, we didn't do what was available to us to get it done. And I don't have confidence, given the last 15 years of voluntarism, that it's going to happen just with the incentives Newt's talked about.
Well, let me... Let me just make 2 points with this. And I obviously we have a significant difference about how we think government works. First of all, I think if you have the right level of tax credit, it isn't just exactly voluntary. I mean, my guess is there's a dollar number at which you would have every utility in the country agree they're all going to build carbon sequestering power plants. So this, I mean, I think that this is a definable alternative.
You know, this is a huge transition. You actually want the government to do it. I want the private sector to do it.
No. I want the government to help
pay for
it.
Because you want the government to pay for it with a great big tax credit. If it's big enough to do what you say, it's actually going to be more expensive than letting the private sector go out and capitalize it in the private market.
Well, let me just say because what you just did is reverse the way you want to do it. What you want to do is create a level of pain sufficiently great that in order to avoid the pain, they'll go raise the capital.
No, I don't want to create a level of pain.
What I want to do is create a level of pleasure sufficiently great that in order to have the pleasure, they'll go ahead and build the plant. It's just a question of which of the two models you prefer.
I want to create... on the contrary, there's no level of pain. Either way, it's a question of how you distribute the benefit. The benefit is that you're going to reduce the carbon and preserve the planet.
Right.
Now, if you call that pain, I call that upside benefit. But that's the benefit. And the benefit is going to come either by spreading it throughout the economy as a whole, or you're going to have the government pay for it. That's basically what you're saying. You want the research, you want the tax credit. That's a government solution.
Look, in the Lincoln,
I want to create a standard and let the private sector solve it.
Now, you want to impose by government. No, wait a second. But let's be fair here. You want to impose by government coercion a standard.
Well, what did you do on the Clean Air Act? Was that coercion on the Clean Air Act when you supported
that? Sure was.
That?
And my argument is that I think we will get faster change through incentives than we will through...
Well, why didn't you do it that way? Why didn't you do it that way on Clean Air?
Well, listen, I think if I could go back and do it that way, I'd probably go back and recommend incentives for clean air. I think I would recommend to get cars, and you have yourself recommended, to get to cleaner cars, that a tax incentive, in fact, would be very helpful to the American auto industry to achieve it. But let me go a step further. Because I think this is, again, part of where we just see the world differently. I believe if we can accelerate enough innovation, we dramatically increase the likelihood of China and India moving towards green prosperity. If you truly believe 10 years is decisive, no strategy which does not bring in China and India works. And this is a very important core problem.
I concur.
Okay. So I don't think China and India are going to go to coercion for their own economy in the next decade. But I think they might go towards pleasure. And I think if we could find ways to have green prosperity that was profitable for them and gave them a better future, I think they would adopt it. The question is, which of our two models is more likely to incite the maximum number of entrepreneurs to invent a new generation of technology and a new generation of consumer goods? And I think this is a perfectly legitimate debate. I mean, I'm not automatically saying that coercion and bureaucracy isn't an answer. I just don't think it's as positive and as creative an answer as market incentives in terms of getting the kind of change we want.
Former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich in an April 10th debate with former Democratic presidential candidate and current U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, John Kerry. The debate was held in Washington and organized by New York University. If you missed part of today's debate, or if you would just like to hear it again, just go to our website. It's wordforword.org. There you can hear this week's show, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches from Hillary Clinton, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Jimmy Carter. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penkava. Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And we had help this week from Sam Keenan. American Public Media.